All right, so hi, Dr. Geertz. Thank you so much for being with us today. So I was thinking we could just talk a little bit about the paper that you co-authored, Winberg et al., and how it talks about the use of AI in predicting hypotension during surgery. And I guess my first question would be, how did you get involved in AI? What was your interest that initially sparked this as a venture of yours?
Right. Well, thank you for the invite and allowing me to speak about this topic. So I got into this because I thought, well, the way we're working, it's not very efficient. You clearly see wherever you work in most hospitals that it's been around for quite a long time. So you have a lot of legacy systems, and it's quite a work around, quite hard to work around a number of things. My thought was that in academia, doing medical research, clinical research, we would come up with a lot of solutions, but I do see that it's pretty hard to actually get them implemented. I'm talking basically about anything other than developing new drugs, that is. What I found was that we're collecting a lot of data. Everyone's working with an electronic health record. I think in the US, it's like 97% of hospitals or clinics. Why don't we use that? And in a way, we're doing medical research day in, day out. Why don't we use that data? But also with AI, that's kind of the bridge between not only doing research, but applying it, using that knowledge, and either you use it for predictions or other things. So it's kind of I thought that was a really charming idea. Then I naively went out into the world to look for people that actually know something more about this, other than just the highlights that I just told you. I just bumped into a couple of people, and by luck, I kind of bumped into some of the smarter people in the world. And one of the topics that we touched was low blood pressure. And basically, here I think, and that project really shows how easy it can be when you put the right people in the room. We have this problem, it's low blood pressure, it's not good for you. And within 3 years, with the help, well, Edwards Lifesciences and another number of smart people, we're able to bring it from a concept to actually a product that could be used anywhere in the world. And normally these innovations take like 17 years, I think the number is. It's kind of like the iPhone 1 coming out next year, more or less. That's kind of the delay that we have looking at other sectors. And AI is something that you can basically, if you do it well, you can pretty quickly turn it into something that's applicable.
And knowing that you have a background in anesthesiology, I was just wondering about the issue of hypotension during surgery. I think the paper mentions that it could be caused by anesthetic drugs, some comorbidities, and some surgical manipulations. But what is it that's occurring inside of the patient's body that leads to this hypotension? And then what are some of the risks if this hypotension isn't treated?
So I mean, of course, it occurs during anesthesia, but basically anywhere in the hospital. There are now papers coming out finally with wearables being available, but even in the wards, we see it a lot, but we didn't previously see it because we only measured blood pressure basically 3 times a day, or four if we do a good job. So now that we measure it in a more structured, continuous fashion, we actually see that it's throughout the hospital, and we also see that association between the occurrence of low blood pressure, especially when it's longer or deeper, or the combination of the two, you see that there's a clear association with poorer outcomes. So for anesthesia, it's pretty simple. The longer you have it, the deeper it is, the worse you can do. The odds just go up that you will have either a myocardial infarction or some other adverse outcome. So why does it happen? It's a number of things. It's of course the pathology of the patient. Some people, I mean, you're a perfectly healthy person, young, so I'll probably need to give you a lot of sedatives to make your blood pressure suffer. But there are a lot of people out there that have a lot of comorbidities. I mean, your average anesthesia patient has at least three chronic diseases with them, which means that the capacity to compensate for whatever you're doing with your anesthetics is just smaller, more limited. So they are more prone to be hypotensive. And of course, then there's the surgeon and the team and whatever they're doing. Either it's bleeding, so it's the preload side, you can see that the vessels are vasodilation, or basically vasodilatation through the sedatives, anesthetics, leading to a lower blood pressure, but also contractility. Sometimes in some patients, you can see that that's suffering as well, either because the organs that are touched, an inflammatory response to the extent of the surgery, or again, the anesthetics itself.
Okay. And then given that it seems that low blood pressure can occur to many patients throughout the hospital with many different conditions, is there a reason why in the paper the studies focus specifically on elective non-cardiac surgeries?
I think it's the beginning. It's like most trials, you need to like build a framework, limit kind of the patients that you enter into your study. But we then currently we're doing trials in cardiac patients. Mm-hmm. It's a matter of taste, it's just to limit basically to make it more a uniform population. But you can do it in pediatrics probably as well, if you would have the tools and a number of other groups. Actually, I think that the non-elective cases are where you will see a bit more low blood pressure and unexpected events occurring, but they're harder to enter into a study. You basically have to have someone on call for 24 hours a day. And that's, of course, so it's basically a logistical reason not to do that.
That makes sense. Yeah. So now that we're going to get into a little bit more about the system itself, let's say in a theoretical situation, the alarm goes off to alert an anesthesiologist that low blood pressure is expected to occur. What would then be the next steps that the anesthesiologist would take after hearing that alert?
Yeah, so I think, and also looking at you at the group that you're targeting here, the listeners, the interesting thing here is that you kind of get an alarm that's early. But what we now need to learn, and radiologists are really aware, if I do a certain test, their sensitivity is this, specificity is this. Mm-hmm. So they really know about each and every test. If you want to catch a certain problem, you should do a certain test. That's all based on these performance metrics of the test. Anesthetists, intensivists are rarely trained at this. Mm-hmm. So I think it's really good to get a closer look at that. So in the paper, we mentioned a number of metrics, and one is the predictive value. So mm-hmm. looking at the performance of this tool, we actually see that if the alarm goes, or doesn't go rather, there's very little chance that anywhere in the next hour or something, you will see a low blood pressure event. Of course, there are some things you can't predict, like behavior of a surgeon. Mm-hmm. But just looking at that, that's one of the things that it delivers to you. It's kind of, you can attend to other things because the alarm is not going. If the alarm goes, it's not 100% accurate. Oh. So in about 25% of cases, the alarm goes, but nothing will happen. So it's still up to you as a professional to decide, okay, let me review the patient, look at preload, afterload, and contractility, just like everyone's trained right now. So I think that's really nice here as well. It's about the display as much as about the AI. It leads you next step. There's a screen opening up, and it shows you preload, afterload, and contractility. You review the patient, and then you assess, okay, is this a valid event here, or is there nothing? And then you can either decide to wait or you intervene, looking at certain trends in one of the three domains. You do your intervention, and this is the nice thing. You can reverse a trend in either afterload, preload, or contractility, or a number of them. And you can see that the predictor goes down as well. So you have your feedback loop in that respect too. Mm-hmm. And that's how you can manage it. So it's good to know. And I mean, that's just looking at broader use of AI tools, predictive tools, it's good to know what the performance metrics are and how you use it properly in your clinic. Mm-hmm. And this for this tool, these are the specs, basically, and this is how you use it. Yeah,
so with the fact that you just mentioned that 25% of the time nothing occurs, was that known to the anesthesiologist before they started using the device, or is that something that they later found out?
Yeah, so we believe doing the trial that there's oftentimes a big gap between a trial environment, just mm-hmm. like I mentioned, right, non-elective cases, yeah. or elective cases, that there's a big gap between the reality of a trial and then actual clinical reality.
Yeah.
So we wanted to make that gap as slim as possible.
Makes sense.
And we did that by basically allowing anyone or like 10 physicians to attend to this, mm-hmm. and also a large number of anesthetic nurses. And the only explanation they really got was, if it alarms, review the patient and act what you believe is good. And we gave them kind of a guidance, just saying, well, look at preload, afterload, contractility, like you normally do. Mm-hmm. Pick whatever parameter you want for either of them. And the action that you take is basically the standard that you do anyway. So we didn't tell them what to do, mm-hmm. but we did describe beforehand what we thought was the best course of action in that situation. And very interestingly, without telling them, and there's nothing worse, you as a specialist, as a professional, being told what to do, like protocol, people often don't like that. So the nice thing here is you get the alarm, you actually are the expert, you review the patient, and lo and behold, 85% of times people actually did what we thought was right. Mm-hmm. So we actually got high compliance. Previously, we had like hemodynamic protocols, something called Goldreich therapy, bit like what Emmanuel Rivers did with his sepsis trial, if you know about that. This was really to look at optimizing fluid around surgery, minimizing it in a way, and optimizing cardiac output. That was really a protocol put on people. Mm-hmm. Compliance was so, so poor. I think I did like 200 lectures on that to nurses and everyone. Could be my educational skills for sure, but... yeah, you could see if you had a lapse in giving those courses, giving those lectures, compliance just dropped. And the nice thing here was it was really intuitive and people did the right thing. So in that respect, also the UX part, and we forget that, right? We all think about AI and how wonderful the model is, but the way you present that model, and I think somehow this company did it right. It just took them by the hand, linked it to the training people got, And then move them forward and basically nudge them to do the right thing.
Interesting, because I think sometimes people look at AI as kind of a replacement of what a normal person would do, but it seems like in this case, AI is a tool where the person is still in control of, do I want to use this tool or do I not want to use this tool?
Exactly. Yeah. I think people, some of my colleagues in the beginning were kind of scared of being overtaken, and now you see the first surgeries being done or part of surgeries being done by robots. I think you should look at the sutures and then kind of be comforted that you're not overtaken yet. That will not happen in the next 20 years, I think, for the full surgery. But anyway, I mean, it's about support first. We're basically short on staff all the time. Mm-hmm. During the pandemic and after the pandemic, a lot of people walked away because of the stresses and the system, the bureaucracy, and a number of other things. I think we need that. Just in radiology, we see that the amount of work goes up by 4% every year, but the number of radiologists goes down by 2% or something. Mm-hmm. So you can see we can't sustain that. So we need systems that support us. So I'm not particularly worried about being replaced. I actually think that if we don't push this technology now, that you're going to have so much work that you can't go home anymore. So I'm actually quite happy about it. But the way it's positioned now, and I think that's also a good way of driving innovation, is not aiming to replace a task, but basically aiding you in getting to that decision in a better informed, quicker way, and supporting you there. And the nice thing is, normally if you start giving people advice, they won't take it, especially professionals in any branch. Mm-hmm. But here you can see that they're now, I see this prediction. And even on an individual level, hypertension occurs more often in one case, mm-hmm. or can occur more often. So you kind of get a confirmation, you build that trust with the tool, even in one case sometimes. So they take that, they start using it, they like it, it leads to different behavior in terms of treatment. And now people start asking, yeah, why don't you give me the advice what to do? Because you're doing such a good job. So slowly we're building that trust. So it's kind of I call it the Tesla model for myself. if you build an electric car, there's no reason to let in any air. But the first time they produced a Tesla, it was just looking like a normal car, but there was no need for it. And so if mm-hmm. people respect that, I think we'll slowly see more support. And indeed, some tasks may be taken away, but ultimately we need that. So long answer to a short question.
Well, thank you. It was a good answer. And I was just wondering, because the original waveform data of it was about 1,300 patients was used to create this AI software. Are there any plans to create an algorithm that maybe uses a specific patient's waveform data, maybe from their electronic health record, to get more personalized predictions? Or would the plan be to expand the data set to include millions of patients potentially?
So I think the performance is already so good. I mean, it's an area under the rock curve of like 0.96 or something, 0.98 even. So, which means that sensitivity and specificity at some point, some cutoff is about 100%. Okay. So that shows it's already very, very accurate. Mm-hmm. That being said, that's only for predicting a map of 65 meters of mercury for 1 minute or longer. In that case, right? But that set point, to go back to your question, will be different for everyone. So what's a good normal blood pressure? Uh-huh. When do we make sure that if you are sedated, that at least your brain is perfused properly? We are in that auto-regulation area. We don't know. We can't tell. So that set point is probably different from one person to the next. And especially, I mean, for younger people, auto-regulation is like big wide area, so you'll compensate. But when you get older and have a higher disease burden, that probably gets smaller. Mm-hmm. You probably need to target, be sure of your target. But that's difficult. And I know they're working on that now. And I don't know how much data we need for that, but also I don't know how we can get to that endpoint. So what is the right individual blood pressure? I don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, we know from antihypertensive drugs, but regulating someone's blood pressure, it's important to look at gender, age, and certain comorbidities or smoking mm-hmm. habits. We know that. So it probably translates to the set point being different for everyone. I just don't know a scientific entry point to get that right, except for measuring it per organ system, and indeed for a lot of patients. But that will be a huge data effort, I'm afraid. So we're not there yet. For now, it's already like a year back, it wasn't possible to have a shifting. So basically tell the algorithm which target to have, the map of 75, 65. So just to get through the FDA approval process, there was one target, 65, mm-hmm. syncing with history and a bit of the association outcome data that's available and came out of Cleveland. And now it's possible. So they're changing the rules with the FDA. And so now we are able to target other cutoffs. So that's already the next step. But for me, the real barrier is, like you just mentioned, individual optimization. Mm-hmm. And I think we're a long way from that yet.
Interesting. So if that's an issue for the development of future AI technology, currently for the people that don't use AI technology, how do they figure out the set point of their patient?
Well, so for the 65 milliliters of mercury, you mean, how did they get to that point? And well, one is history, right? So if you, I'm getting older. So 20 years ago, when I was taught criteria for sepsis, so map of 65 was in that. So if you define shock, map of 65 or above was kind of a target that you have to have. Mm-hmm. All based on older people, professors, experts deciding that was a good point. Now, looking back, we finally have some data to underpin it. So what was based on eminence is now actually proven, or at least there's on a population basis. So the Cleveland Outcome Group, it's called the Somasi paper, basically. I think it's in anesthesiology. And they showed, if you look at 100,000 people or more and look at associations between different outcomes, it's kind of a curve. So hypertension is not good for you. Low blood pressure is certainly not good for you. And that kind of change in that risk curve is around 65 milliliters of mercury for the population. So that kind of confirmed the old-fashioned way we got to that rule. And that's why they had to pick that one point, just basically also because the FDA only allowed you that.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. So I guess maybe a little bit of shift, because AI can be used for many different kinds of predictive abilities. And I know you've currently been working on Periscope technology, which predicts the likelihood of infection post-surgically. And I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so what we're doing now, so I started the company, full disclaimer. and I see now that that's actually a full-time effort to build a tool to basically allow it to scale and create the impact, the influence that we want to reach. Mm-hmm. And that's as many patients as possible, basically. So we now see basically that one in five patients, this is not only literature data, but also something that we now see in the data that we get, gets an infection after their surgery. So we're looking at adult patients undergoing surgery. I live in Amsterdam. In the Netherlands, we do 1.4 million surgeries, which is about 8% of the population per year. And one in five of them get treated for an infection after the surgery. And there's also a long-term impact. One out of three that get that infection actually have to kind of enjoy that for another year with a chronic infection. So there's a huge impact. And what we wanted to do is really to start focusing more. So I was really annoyed as an intensivist that I got called in 1 week to the same ward, basically different room every night, different patients, same surgery, sepsis. So we basically discovered the infection late, which meant the patient was critically ill, was in septic shock, had to be taken to ICU, stayed there for a week or more, multiple surgeries, and then ultimately most of them survived and got out, but had a long, basically recovery in front of them. And what I wanted to do was basically alert early. When the infection was small, you could treat it in a more less invasive, simpler fashion, and hopefully make people recover more quickly and recover back to their old standard. So I was pretty sure that data was present in the electronic health record. So we build a tool that basically looks at 50 or so features, 50 or so parameters, like gender, like age, like BMI, but also the type of surgery, how long you had the surgery, and start doing predictions at this point in time, still right after the surgery, and then you get like a daily update. So that means that you basically, as a surgeon, as a physician, can focus on certain patients. And we're now looking at the performance in a randomized controlled trial, more or less. You can't really randomize or at least blind people for the use of this tool. We're now looking at the impact. Basically looking at how we can cut that whole period short. So the average diagnosis is now done on day 5. And we're just trying to make that diagnosis possible on day 1 after the surgery. So you basically gain 4 days on average, and hopefully that will reduce the cost, the impact for the patient.
Okay. So just correct me if I'm wrong, would this kind of technology be used maybe in the pre-surgical process when speaking with the patient on whether they want to have a surgery or not?
Ultimately, yes. So we now trained it on maybe 250,000 different patients. We're now 2 weeks away from a bigger data set of 2.5 million patients, and they're having had their surgery. So yes, ultimately. So we now look at, say, colon surgery. We can actually do that prediction pretty accurately. So back to the AUROC, now I explained it, that's 0.96. So really close to the one, to the perfect kind of sensitivity and specificity. And we now get the same kind of numbers when we do it before for that subpopulation. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there are some challenges, right? There are mathematical challenges. So if you have colon surgery, chances are pretty high that you get an infection. It's like 13% or something. And ultimately, not every population has that high of a percentage, so it's harder to train a model. You need more people to go into the machine learning model to actually build a reliable one. So it's now we start at the end of the surgery and do the prediction, basically because you had that physiological challenge, you had the anesthetics, you had the surgery, the body was tested, and we saw how it responded, and that also extrapolates to a certain risk. But yes, ultimately, that's what we're going for. You need to know what you're up to, what you're up against. And also, we want to enable and empower patients. If we learn that BMI, if you reduce it by, say, 1, so take off 5 kilograms or something, that makes your risk go down significantly. I think that's a way of making it come alive for a patient. It's really hard. They're now very, they're kind of like objects. We just do the intervention. There's no role for the patient oftentimes. And that's something I want to, together with all the other initiatives, want to take away. Tell you what the risk is and what you can do about it before you go into the surgery, and then see if we can improve it. Again, long answer.
So this kind of technology, is it able to identify where the what the cause of the risk is? For example, if it's a patient's body weight, or it might be like a previous condition that they've had before?
Yeah, so something called causal inference. So what you're looking at is basically associations, correlations, and not per se that there's that the cause is there.
Yeah.
So in a way, it's also dangerous to say that we put a prediction in front of you, and oftentimes people want explanations, right? They want to trust it, so they want to learn more about how you got there. Mm-hmm. If we start communicating that, you might also risk that people do intervention that you don't want. So say potassium or sodium is part of that prediction and in a negative way contributes to that risk, people might start intervening by giving fluids and maybe add like 2 liters of fluid to reduce the concentration of that electrolyte, which is obviously not something you want to do because probably the fluids contribute to the risk and not take it away. So that's kind of a danger. But there's now an approach called causal inference. And that's used by a lot of machine learners to try and tease out what actually is indeed causing it. And that, I think, indeed, is the key to allow both professionals to act and prevent in a deeper way, but also patients to take their role.
Interesting. So currently, if the Periscope technology were to predict that there is a considerable risk of post-surgical infection, what would the response be by the surgeon potentially to help reduce that risk?
Right. So if it's really low and it stays low, we foresee now that they can use it to discharge the patient earlier, because 15% of patients are readmitted globally after their surgery. So that number could go down. On the other end of the spectrum, you could decide people to stay longer to keep a closer eye on, closer look at them. And we also see that you do some tests. So it's not that we want people to give antibiotics based on our prediction. We're not making that claim yet. I think for that we need to do a lot more research, which is an important point for data science, for AI. We need clinicians to give that input. So I think that's if there is a message in there for future doctors, I think that's one of them. Really do that, because otherwise you get systems that are of no use or even dangerous. So for me, it's really raising an alarm. What's that patient? And for that one, you're doing well. And then it's a matter of, do you want to do an ultrasound, basically additional testing. And that's what we already started doing. So we basically did, and we based that on financial endpoints. If you do the predictions and take in the errors that we make, because it's not perfect, it means that for one hospital, we spend 16,000 euros extra, but we anticipate to save about 160,000. Dutch numbers, so they make no sense in the US, but it's kind of the trade-off. You also need to look at what you invest, but also the burden that you put on patients. So basically, for those 1,200 patients that we looked at, we made the doctors do about 150 blood draws in addition to what they normally do. So that's the burden, that's the investment. And some of them were not needed. That's where the prediction was off. And in some cases, it led to earlier prediction. Or earlier finding of the infection and earlier treatment.
So to touch upon like my last question would be, you talked a little bit about the future, how clinicians need to provide more data to make more reliable systems. This might be a little bit out there, but what do you see as the future, maybe AI in medicine, maybe a future product of yours or something that you hope somebody else one day takes upon to kind of change the face of medicine?
Well, one is really close to home. We spend 45% of our time putting in data into the electronic health record. If you're a GP or wherever you're working in a hospital, that's what you're doing as a professional. You didn't sign up for that, and actually leads to burnout. So the technology, voice recognition, and those kinds of things that are already happening, I actually expect that to make our lives as physicians, but also as patients, a lot easier. So it's really something that is already done at home with Siri or however, whatever device you have. That technology is now coming into the hospital. And I think that's making our lives a lot better potentially. And yeah, then you'll see we're moving slowly towards the more difficult stuff, the more of the liabilities are, the diagnostics. So just to give you some examples, pathologists are hugely reliable. They're very accurate in what they do. But then you take away the time. So basically say, now you don't do it in 20 minutes, you do it in 7 and look at all those slides. And then the accuracy starts to suffer. So that's where that support makes you more efficient and a better doctor. And that's where whatever job you have, whatever specialty you have, I think that we'll see much, much more of that. And just for like the really rare cases, but also the very menial stuff and the more common diagnostics, we'll see more support, making our lives easier and a bit safer. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and we need that because we're short on staff. So.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like AI is one of the potential solutions to the shortage of staff issue that medical professionals face across the world.
One of the, it's there's never a golden bullet. It's there's going to be errors. We're going to see things go wrong, like biases. I mean, Google made some huge blunders with their archiving AI, right? Basically, you saw that it was all based on white people going into their models and too few people with other skin colors. So that led to some awful archiving issues, to put it like that. And we'll see that also happen in AI being used on in healthcare. So it's not going to be a solution. It's not going to be. We really need to be very careful that we validate it properly. And that's something that's now evolving. You see the guidelines coming up. Okay, so this is how you build up the evidence that something is safe. Which is also a danger because if you put more rules in, just like with pharma, it becomes more expensive because the investment is so much higher. So I see it as a really good way of using, creating value from our existing data. But because of all those new rules, most of them need to be there, we make it more expensive. So and ultimately, it's about the sustainability. So that's it's a big challenge there that we keep AI cheap. And I don't see that whether we're going to keep that actually going. I don't know. That's the big challenge. Yeah. Right?
Well, thank you, Dr. Geertz, so much for all the information on, I guess, this new frontier of medicine, which involves AI. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Anthony.
If you like this episode, please consider subscribing and rating our show. It really helps us out a lot. For updates on upcoming episodes or to send in questions for our guest speakers, you can follow us on Instagram at No Scrubs Podcast. That's No Scrubs with a Z. Thank you so much for listening. We hope you had as great of a time as we did.